Okay, quick. What does the trade war have in common with a bottle of shampoo? Think about it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, 5 September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. All right, you had like 20 seconds there during the credits. What'd you come up with? Trade war and a bottle of shampoo. What do you got? Well, how about this? Lather, rinse, repeat. I think it's kind of apt myself because once again today, we had murmurings of progress in trade negotiations between Washington and Beijing. And once again today, traders took that as a signal to send the major indices up and up a bunch to lather, rinse, repeat. Kind of works, right? Those murmurings of progress, by the way, high-level talks in Washington early October is the time frame. Not too many more specifics than that. Those trade talks, or more accurately, the lack of them, featured prominently in the most recent edition of the Federal Reserve's Beige Book, which was out yesterday. It is, you'll remember, a regional and anecdotal compilation of current economic conditions around the country and offers in its pages something of a real-life trade war behavioral economics experiment. How are retailers figuring out where to set prices now that the Trump administration's tariffs are making things more expensive? Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports on the results.
There's this anecdote in the Beige Book about a major retail chain in New York. Doesn't say which one. It decided, because of the tariffs, to raise prices on its furniture and other big-ticket items. Customers responded so negatively that the retailer is probably going to cut prices again. The price hike didn't work because of the kind of products we're talking about.
It's a choice. You know, you can buy that new furniture now, or you can live another few months with that same old sofa.
Robert Schindler, who teaches marketing at Rutgers Business School, says some businesses can get away with raising prices because customers need what they're selling.
Back-to-school products, food products, if you have repairs that need to be done, paying electricity bill.
Some retailers are trying to hide price hikes. The Beige Book said in Chicago, some stores are raising prices very slowly, hoping their customers don't notice. Barbara Kahn, a marketing professor at the Wharton School, says that can work. But
if you're aware of a tactic that the retailer is using and you feel manipulated, people don't like it. So you know, they feel duped.
Kahn says a simpler approach might work. Research in behavioral economics suggests that people are willing to pay a higher price if they think it's justified. So retailers could explain to customers why they're raising prices.
The regular price is here. The tariffs went up. As soon as the tariffs change or if something changes in the economic situation, we intend to take this price off.
Retailers that don't want to be guinea pigs in this experiment could take a cue from Target. It told suppliers recently not to pass along the cost of tariffs. Then again, we are talking about one of the biggest retailers in the country. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
There has been, if not a drumbeat, then a steady stream of coverage, perhaps, here and elsewhere, that a recession is a-coming. And to be clear, it is. We just don't know when. But in the interests of equal time today, a brief detour into the flip side of that coin.
My name is Julie Smith. I'm an associate professor of economics at Lafayette College.
The flip side of recession being the idea that if you take a step back, the nuts and bolts of this economy ain't doing too bad.
And so one of the economic fundamentals that I'm interested in is the inflation rate.
Inflation's been pretty low in this economy for a good long while. Now, that is good for consumers, steady prices, right? Kind of a mixed bag, big picture, really. But Julie Smith looks at something else as well.
But I'm more interested in the job creation number.
We're going to talk jobs on the ground in Austin, Texas, in a minute with Andy Euler. But for Julie Smith, new jobs in this economy, that's the whole smash.
I think a strong economy is one where jobs are being created over time and can absorb people who want to either change jobs or enter the labor force and find work.
Job growth's been doing all right this year. The whole labor market, in fact, is on a 10-year uptrend. Wages are finally rising as well. So that's all good.
My name is Anat Admati, and I am a professor of finance and economics at Stanford Graduate School of Business.
Unemployment, yes, says Anat Admati, but also?
Unemployment could be a measure. Would you want people to work? So that's certainly looking a little bit better. And, you know, people are spending, stock prices are high, but stock prices were also very high in 2006. And then it didn't turn out that well.
Which is to say, strong fundamentals might not be all that they seem.
What people really should understand is that it's actually quite fragile because a lot of it is really built on debt. In other words, corporations and individuals too use a lot of borrowed money to fund all the stuff they're doing. A lot of risks can come back.
Julie Smith gets the economic fundamentals last word.
If I go back and I think about talking about either inflation or talking about employment, right, that trade war that has been going on is going to affect both of those as well. Because if businesses are uncertain, they'll be less likely to hire more workers.
Speaking of which, the trade war that is, lather, rinse, repeat, was music to the ears of the markets today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As I was alluding to a moment ago, the monthly peek into the guts of the American labor market lands at 8:30 tomorrow morning, Washington time. The August jobs report, technically called the employment situation summary. There will be two big pieces of information, as you know, how many jobs the economy added or possibly lost last month, and then the unemployment rate. What percentage of the 163 or so million people in the American labor force who want jobs but don't have them? 3.7% was the July number. Best guesses are August is going to be pretty much the same. And look, 3.7% is pretty low, but for all the talk from economists about how we are basically at full employment right now, things look different out in the actual job market. That's especially evident in a place like Austin, Texas, home of a 2.9% unemployment rate, as Marketplace's Andy Euler found out.
By the time I meet up with 59-year-old Lisa Donahoe at a cafe in North Central Austin for lunch, she's already logged half a day of work, unpaid.
So I set my alarm. I wake up in the morning. I go to my computer. I look at all my job matches, and I go through them. And I do that all day long.
Donahoe got laid off in mid-May from her job as a quality control manager at a tech company. She keeps a detailed, color-coded spreadsheet to keep track of jobs. The jobs she's applied for, the ones where she was interviewed but wasn't chosen, and then there are the lines in red.
They didn't contact me for an interview, and they just sent me an email saying they looked at my resume, but they decided to go with another candidate or a different approach. Or the job just got closed and I never heard anything.
In 3.5 months, she's applied for almost 40 jobs in Austin.
Somebody said something that made a lot of sense to me. The good news is you're in Austin, Texas. The bad news is you're in Austin, Texas. There are tons of jobs, but there's also a lot of qualified people.
Many of those qualified people are just out of college, and Donahoe is worried that her age could be a deterrent to some potential employers. She doesn't have family members relying on her income, but she also doesn't want to rack up a bunch of credit card debt. Donahoe says if she doesn't have a full-time job with a decent salary by the end of the month, she'll piece it together with part-time gigs.
If I have to do 4 jobs to make ends meet, then that's what I'll do.
Across town, Chris Winnie's also been putting in a lot of time looking for a job. I meet up with the 43-year-old at his house in southwest Austin.
Hi, Chris. How you doing? Come on in.
He says until recently, he was out of work by choice.
I have been a stay-at-home dad for about 10 years. Before that, I got a PhD in ecology. The plan was to be a professor somewhere.
Winnie says he could afford to stay at home with his 2 sons because his wife was making good money as a physical therapist. Now they're divorced and he needs to work. He's been looking for a full-time job in the tech industry for about 6 months, and he's frustrated that his expensive education isn't really helping.
HR departments aren't necessarily curious about whether or not I have a PhD from 2008 that I haven't really been using. I mean, it's essentially been sitting there, you know, collecting dust.
He also knows employers are leery of someone who's been out of the workplace for so long.
I feel like most HR departments are wanting to know, what have you been doing the last few years? And they maybe are taking the safe road and hiring somebody straight out of college or somebody who's been doing the exact same thing and they're just making a lateral transition.
Now, Winnie's got a new plan. He's currently enrolled in a program to get his high school teaching certificate, but that's going to take a while, so he'll keep hoping something else comes along.
I think there's a lot of vulnerability and shame in letting people know that you're having a hard time getting a job. It'd be a lot more satisfying to show up to a job and have colleagues that you're working with than it is to sit at home and apply for jobs.
to stay afloat financially when he's tapped the equity in his house. And he's working as a substitute teacher and as a waiter at some private events when he can. He knows the job market is supposed to be favorable right now. People saying, if you want a job, you can get one. He's just trying to figure out how that's supposed to work for him. In Austin, Texas, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
One of the big questions a company has to answer when it starts even thinking about going public is valuation. What are we worth? Deciding on that number and then trying to guess what the market might do when that first trading day comes is far from an exact science. In the case of the We Company, the parent of the co-working startup WeWork, it's apparently a very inexact science. The company's initial public offering has been in the works for a while now at a generally accepted valuation of something like $47 billion. Today, though, a whole slew of published reports, without confirmation, we should say, but a whole slew of published reports say that WeWork is now looking to go public at a valuation of $20 to $30 billion. There are some concerns about business model and corporate governance, apparently. But given all the skepticism, Marketplace's Amy Scott wanted to know why the rush to go public anyway.
First, there's the market to consider.
The stock market is near an all-time high. There's no guarantee that that's going to continue.
Jay Ritter teaches finance at the University of Florida.
And the company is losing money. They do need external capital.
If we wait and the market turns, it might not be able to raise as much capital. Eric Gordon at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business says there's also pressure from early investors, the venture capital and private equity firms that have funded WeWork so far.
They want to have a way of turning their investment in your company into actual cash.
Gordon says there could be some upside to delaying the IPO, though, like figuring out how to actually make money. According to its IPO filing, WeWork has lost almost $3 billion in the past 3 years.
Maybe you get to change your story a little bit, you get some time to show some better results, and you get a higher valuation.
Whatever the timing, getting that valuation right is key. IPO investors have to think they're going to make money. Kathy Smith is co-founder of Renaissance Capital, which manages an IPO exchange-traded fund. She says investors have been burned by other recent high-profile debuts. Shares in Uber and Lyft have been trading at 25 to 30% below their IPO prices.
Those are large, highly valued, money-losing companies. So when a company comes out that looks like that, now, after seeing how Uber and Lyft performed, they're going to be a lot more cautious.
WeWork declined to comment. There are reports the company might start its IPO roadshow to drum up interest as early as next week. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The average garment's worn 7 times before it's thrown away.
Why Mother Nature isn't really so into your shopping habits. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 372 points today, 1.4%, 26,728. The NASDAQ advanced 139 points, that's 1.7% there. Ended things at 81.16. The S&P 500 tacked on 38 points, 1.3%, 29.76. Lather, rinse, repeat, gang. That's what I'm talking about. Marielle Segarra was talking about tariff pricing up earlier. Target among them. Shares of Target ticked up 1% today. Amazon grew 2.2%. Shares of Walmart down, though, 0.4%. Lululemon, the athleisure apparel company, released second quarter earnings after the bell. Revenue's very nice. Thank you very much. Stock rallied in after-hours trading. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.56%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are told, and experience generally bears this out, that we're living in the age of peak TV, which is great, except sometimes, right, it feels a bit like a fire hose. So much content, so little time. And it's only going to get worse as Disney, Apple, and Warner Media start competing for our eyeballs and subscription dollars in the next couple of months. So streaming services are having to get creative to keep us engaged beyond the binge. Marketplace's Jack Stewart has that one.
Turn on the TV and pull up Netflix. Find The Great British Baking Show and settle in for a few hours on the sofa. That's what show fan Katie Stoll had in mind.
For me, the beauty of Great British Baking Show, I mean, outside of it just being a lovely, positive, heartwarming experience, is that you sit down and you can watch multiple of them in a row.
But disaster! She found a little note saying new episodes weekly.
A new season of Great British Baking Show was like, sweet, I do not have to have weekend plans. And they've taken that away from me.
That outrage is echoed on Twitter amongst betrayed British baking enthusiasts. Dan Herbert at the University of Michigan says it seems like a surprise move.
Netflix made such a name for itself and distinguished itself in the field of streaming or television because of their binge tactic, right?
Netflix has actually been doing weekly releases for years when shows are also broadcast by someone else in a different market.
On your marks, get set.
The British Baking Show is broadcast on Channel 4 in the UK and then hits Netflix US the day after. But Netflix is experimenting with an original competition show, Rhythm and Flow, which it will release in batches. Charlotte Howell studies media and television at Boston University.
A lot of the kind of streaming platforms are starting to echo a lot of older legacy processes of television, like producing week to week.
It's what Hulu does with originals like The Handmaid's Tale, and Disney Plus and Apple TV Plus will reportedly also go weekly. Howell says the new kids on the TV block are realizing that services like HBO may have had the right idea to string TV out, give shows a chance to build buzz, and crucially, keep people subscribed. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
A definition here to set up this next item: fast fashion. Clothing that's manufactured really quickly, very cheaply, usually overseas, and sold relatively inexpensively at places like Walmart and H&M and Zara, places like that. It's a manufacturing model that's really bad for the environment, though, and for the people doing the actual manufacturing. But what to do about that has been maybe less clear. All of it is the subject of a new book. It's called Fashionopolis: The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes, written by Dana Thomas. Dana, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So fast fashion, we know about, as I was just saying. Give me a sense, though, of the impact, the scale, the effect. I mean, there's so many clothes out there. It's mind-boggling.
There are so many clothes out there. You know, fashion has grown from a $500 million a year business to a $3 trillion a year business in, you know, a matter of decades. We throw away millions of tons worth of clothes every year. We burn through clothes, and we keep them less and less. The average garment's worn 7 times before it's thrown away, and in China, it's 3 times.
Which is staggering. But to the purpose of this interview and the book, do you think the person who is thumbing through the racks at H&M or what have you realizes that, or, and this is really cynical, cares?
I do think they care once they know. I think is that we don't know. It's a bit like the fast food industry. We didn't realize what hamburgers were made of until we read Fast Food Nation. Then we said, oh my gosh, I had no idea this was all going on behind the scenes from meat to bun. And I tried to do that with the fashion business and show that, you know, this is where our cotton comes from, that synthetic indigo that's used in our jeans is not good for you, that the mountains that are going to the landfill do not disintegrate or biodegrade because they're made of polyester, and polyester is plastic, that it's raining microfibers now and we can find it in the Rocky Mountains. I think once you know that, then you think about it, but we didn't know it.
Let me mix my corporate metaphors, if I might. You know how big oil is investing in renewables and doing all these you know, forward-facing things because, in theory, it realizes that, you know, eventually we're going to run out of oil and we're all going to have to be more sustainable about it, and it's a business imperative for them.
Right.
Are there clothing retailers and manufacturers who are doing that?
Absolutely. H&M is doing it in a big way. They're going to only source what they call sustainable cotton by 2020. That's not organic, mind you. It's still GMO, but it's cleaner and better than conventional cotton. They want to be climate positive by 2030. And they say it's because they want to stay in business forever. And they said, we know that the supply chain as it is today is unsustainable, and we won't have anything to source if we keep going at the rate we're going. They're supporting companies like Worn Again, which takes cotton poly blends and separates them and then regenerates both into virgin, back to molecular level, and then virgin material. They're on it. But there are a lot of companies that are also greenwashing, so you got to watch out for that.
Okay, but, and as you write in this book, cost wins out over virtually everything. Can you still make this stuff at a price point at which the average consumer says, yeah, that's a deal for me, I'm going to buy that?
I think the more that the companies take this on, the more it will become affordable. Also, yeah, it's okay if we pay more than we're than $19.99. One of the biggest surprises I learned when I was working on the book was a piece I read in The New Yorker from 1940 that talked about Hattie Carnegie selling suits, the Secretary Special, as Raymond Chandler called it in The Long Goodbye, for $19.99 at the height of the Depression. We're still paying $19.99 for a suit 100 years later, while the cost of ground beef has gone up 100 times.
Right.
So I think, you know, we need to not buy 10 things at $10, but one thing at $100, and we'll already see a difference in our impact.
Yeah, but yes to all of that, but have you met the American consumer? I mean, not to speak ill of all of us, but come on, price is everything.
Price is everything. But I think, you know, that's the point I'm trying to make with the book, that we need to put integrity back into our shopping and into our purchases, and we need to buy things that we really care about and not just consume for the sake of consuming.
Dana Thomas, the book is called Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes. It's kind of fascinating, actually. Dana, thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
As always, we've got an excerpt of Dana's book for you. It's marketplace.org. I realize I'm talking my own book here a little bit, but voice is really having a moment. Actual voice, the speaking thing. There's the obvious stuff like podcasts, right? And then the less obvious stuff like e-learning platforms and gizmos like Siri and Alexa, which means there's a whole lot of voice demand. That's our way into this latest installment of our every once in a while series, which we call My Economy.
My name is Miles Chicoine. I am the founding managing director of Voquent.com, which is an online marketplace for voices and voice agencies and production companies. We created the company because looking at voiceover work from the outside, when I'd originally tried to commission a piece of work, I realized that it wasn't quite as straightforward as I wanted it to be, and I happened to have a friend. He suggested that perhaps a business should be started that actually enables companies who are looking for voices to find everything in one place quickly and easily. The globalization of the internet and the availability of technology for studios at home has really made it possible for a lot more people to get into the voice acting industry, and that's made a huge amount of different types of accents and types of voices much more accessible to everyone across the planet. So when we launched, we had no voices on the site. We had no clients. We had nothing. Now we've worked with coming up to about 200 clients, and we've got about 14,000 or so voices on the site. We get requests for accents that we don't yet have all the time. Somebody could call up and say, I need a teenage voice from, you know, some obscure part of the world that nobody does voiceover work in, really. And then the hunt is on. And that's just a matter of time. We just need to keep building out our site and our system and the capability to pick up all those accents. And you know, it's populating itself because we're getting hundreds and hundreds of demos every single day.
Miles Chicoine of Voquent.com over in the UK, courtesy of our colleagues at the BBC. Can't do this one without you, or, well, technically without your voice. Tell us how your economy is doing at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, a quick follow-on to the item a couple of weeks ago about how Apple said you ought to treat your brand new Apple credit card like, and this is real, if it gets dirty, here's the quote, gently wipe with a soft, slightly damp, lint-free microfiber cloth. Anyway, I mentioned that on the way to this. Apple has made much of the fact that the card is made of titanium. How much titanium? A Bloomberg reporter sent his card to a mineralogist at UC Berkeley. 90% titanium is the answer. 10% aluminum is the rest of it. But here's the question. Why is it 90% titanium? All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's up 372 today, 1.4%. The NASDAQ advanced 139 points, 1.7%. S&P 500 tacked on 38. That is 1.3%. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Heron Bekela, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.